Welcome to the 370th episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. Stay tuned for my interview with Kirsty Manning, author of the novel The Lost Jewels. And stay tuned after the interview for a short excerpt from the audiobook of The Lost Jewels. The Reading and Writing Podcast is brought to you by Libro FM. Libro.fm lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. You can pick from more than 185,000 audiobooks, including bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers. You'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there, but you'll be part of a different story. One that supports your local community and your local bookstore. If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. You can listen during your commute, while doing chores, walking the dog, or just relaxing at home. All you need is a smartphone and the free Libro.fm app. If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to next, check out recommendations and curated lists from people who know audiobooks best, your local bookseller. Here's your special offer from the Reading and Writing Podcast. Get two audiobooks for the price of one today with your first month of membership with the code RWPODCAST at checkout. This offer is only valid for new members in Canada and the U.S. Check out Libro.fm today. Well, welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Kirsty Manning, author of the novels The Song of the Jade Lily and The Midsummer Garden, and her new novel, The Lost Jewels. Kirsty, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, if someone listening hasn't heard about your novel, The Lost Jewels, yet, how would you describe the novel?
Well, it is a multiple time frame mystery based on a true story. It is the story of the Cheapside hoard that is currently homed in the Museum of London. And in 1912, the story goes, some navvies, some workmen dug up 500 pieces of precious jewellery on a worksite in Cheapside, London, just behind St. Paul's Cathedral. And then those jewels quickly disappeared again. They were pocketed, they were pawned. You can imagine to these very impoverished workmen, they really were life-changing for them in many ways. And so it's a great mystery what happened to all the jewels. But somehow a pawnbroker got hold of it and he collected 500 pieces and they ended up in the Museum of London. And so we're fortunate that we do have some. And we're talking an emerald watch the size of a baby's fist, bags of pearls, Byzantine brooches, sapphire rings, and a Champlivre diamond ring. And the Cheapside hoard is my imagined story of that jewellery. So it's a story of Essie, an Irish immigrant whose brother is one of the workmen on the site. And she was there the day the jewels were dug up in 1912. And it is also the story of Kate, a contemporary jewellery historian from Boston, who is sent to London to write a story on the Cheapside jewels. And while she's in London, she decides to write, find out a bit about her great-grandmother's story, Essie, because she doesn't know why Essie left London all those years ago. And she starts to not only research the history of the jewels, but the history of her grandmother's story. And then there's a third strand running through the book, which is an origin story of a piece of jewellery. So we see one of these precious pieces of jewels that's in the museum from origin, so from in the ground, across the trade routes, across the seas, and imagined. We see the process of crafting a piece of jewellery and how it ends up in the museum. And that's all fiction. Yeah, of course.
That's great. Well, you said that there was 500 jewels in the Cheapside jewels that were collected. Have historians been able to speculate about how many there were originally?
Look, they really have no idea, but the breadth of the jewels found and the value of them suggests that it was either a working cache of a jeweler who was repairing for the aristocracy or royalty, because only the very wealthy would have had such a mass of jewels. But don't forget, but they have been managed, they have managed to date the time that they think they were buried based on some later pieces of jewelry, and they put it around the mid-1600s, which of course is the time of the Civil War in England, the Great Fire, and also the plague. So my burning question always was, who would bury 500 pieces of jewellery and never return? And of course, when you overlay that, if you go back to 1666 and you've got the Great Fire and you've got the plague and of course the Civil War before that, there's any number of reasons somebody would hide a cache of jewellery in the ground and never come back.
So when did you first learn about the Cheapside jewels?
I stumbled across an article, a review of the exhibition, quite by accident when I was researching The Song of the Jade Lily, as happens when you're writing historical fiction, you kind of go down rabbit holes of research. And I was doing one, you know, a day of that one day, and just stumbled across this random piece. And I was just enthralled by the story, and I thought there were so many gaps in between what the historians know and what they don't know. It's just ripe for fictionalizing, really.
And did you know at that point you wanted to write about it, and you just set it aside since you were working on something else?
I did. I created a folder on my on my computer, and I started printing out things and put them away. And because, of course, it's very tempting for a shiny new idea to take over when you're in the depths of the murky middle of a novel. It's very tempting to put it aside and think, no, this idea is much better. But so I did. I quietly started reading around it, but I knew that it would make I knew it would make a great story. But it's quite a technical book. And it's, as I said, it's multi-layered, and I just wanted to be sure that I could do it justice. So I needed a big run-up to do this book.
So what can jewels and jewelry tell us about history and specific historical periods?
Well, I mean, the story of jewels is the story of colonization and exploration. I mean, if we look at London in the 17th century, that's the Elizabethan era. That's when Elizabeth's ships were on the seas and the Silk Routes were in operation, and they were going into countries and taking, you know, sapphires and emeralds from Colombia and diamonds from India. And don't forget that jewellery at that time was also, it's very compact and it's very easy to transport. So jewellery was more valuable in some cases than gold coin in countries. Like if you're carrying a bag of rubies or diamonds, I mean, that's just, you're in possession of extraordinary wealth. And so it tells you about the fashions. If you look at what the women were wearing, and at that time, there was a mercantile class rising in London in the 17th century. And so it was possible not to be wealthy, not just as an aristocrat, but as a merchant trader. And so you see those photos of men and women with frilly collars and necklaces, enamel and gold and gem-studded necklaces sewn in and stitched onto their bodices. And they'll have rings stitched into the ruff of their sleeves and the neck, their lace ruffs, just to kind of show their wealth and show, I guess, one up the aristocracy who are losing their wealth. And so it tells you a lot about the tastes of the time. And also a piece of jewellery can be melted down and remade and reshaped over the years. So what's unusual about the Cheapside hoard is we wouldn't have seen, like, the enamel would not have lasted on many of these precious pieces of jewelry because it just would have worn away against the body. And so it's the story of the craftsmanship at the time and the care and the hours that were put into making a single perfect piece of jewelry.
Well, while researching the lost jewels, was there anything that surprised you about the history of jewelry making?
It didn't surprise me, but I actually went to a Cartier exhibition, and at this Cartier exhibition, I mean, many of us, most of us, I will never in my life probably wear a multi-strand diamond necklace anywhere, you know, but to see one up close, it is really, it takes your breath away. The decadence and the extravagance and the exquisite craftsmanship, it really is a pinnacle of beauty and the pinnacle of human achievement. I mean, it's something magical, and it's a team of people that strive to create this piece of magic. And when I was at the Cartier exhibition, I saw some of the sketches where they kind of list exactly how each diamond is going to be cut and faceted and where it's going to be placed on a necklace. And there could be 2,000 diamonds on one of these garlanded necklaces. And it took 2 or 3 years for these pieces of jewelry to be made, just one piece of jewelry, many, many hands. Gem cutters, polishers, designers, goldsmiths, the hand-wrought nature of it and how they all work together to create something so perfect and so exquisite. It really is in very, like, teeny tiny hammers and, you know, it's like painting on a piece of rice. It's so extraordinary, and they're so dedicated. So I think, you know, as a writer, I'm very dedicated to craftsmanship. But when you see, it's that mastery of an art. When you see exquisite jewelry like that, we think it's ostentatious, but it is also representing not just the wearer, but the people who made it. It's their story as well.
Sure. And what's the value of something like that, the one that you mentioned that you saw with the design? Do you remember?
The Cartier, I mean, I think they're priceless. There's some that they wouldn't even sell. I think they replicated one. I saw, you know, the movie Ocean's 8 that had a Cartier necklace. They replicated one that I saw, and that cost $150 million. Apparently.
Oh, God. Wow.
So probably won't be wearing one anytime soon.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are your earliest memories of reading and books?
Well, I grew up in rural Australia, a long way from the city. So books really were my entree into the world. So my earliest memories were, we have a children's story series here called Cutterpot and Snuggle Pie, which is about two little gumnut babies. It's very Australian. And then I read a lot of the British series, the Enid Blyton, and then later getting the American classics, Huckleberry Finn, Catcher in the Rye, To Kill a Mockingbird in my teens. And but what literature gave me when I was very, very young and in my teenage years was an entree into the world. I mean, I hadn't really spent a lot of time in cities at all, and I certainly had never been overseas. But, you know, when I started reading the Russians, I could imagine a Russian winter, and it's 40 degrees Celsius in Tamworth where I grew up in summer, so it's hot, hot, hot. But, you know, you can transport yourself into the most bitter, barren Russian winter you know, through books, have friendship and learn about food that I'd never seen. It really, books really can let you travel outside a world when you can't access it any other way. And I think that's why people are going back to books at the moment, actually. In Victoria, I know you've had a dreadful time. I've been thinking about you all in America, and in Victoria, we're back here in lockdown. So we've got another, I think it's 6 weeks to go where we're not allowed out, except for, you know, essential things. Sure. And so books really are our way of traveling and escape. It's where I've been kind of curling back in. It nurtures you and it feeds the mind. And, you know, I read everything from mysteries to travel to historical fiction, and it's just, it's really quite, it's a way that it broadens your world really quickly. Sure. And it forces you to slow down and think and really engage in a way that watching Netflix doesn't, which, by the way, I have also been watching a lot of.
No, I don't think you're the only one. So what was your path to writing and publishing your first novel?
Well, I studied literature at university, and I worked for a time in book publishing. So I worked as an editor in nonfiction area. And then I, when I had children, I have three kids, I took time out and I freelanced as a publishing manager. And I also started freelancing journalism. So I wrote a lot of feature stories about people. And I did some travel writing and food writing. And the thing about writing features about people and also travel writing is that you've got a very small space on the page. If it's in a newspaper article, if you're in a major broadsheet, say, you have to get to the core of the core of the person or the core of the place really quickly and evoke that for the reader. So it taught me about writing, you know, really sharp characters and giving you the essence of a character or a place, and evoking that for someone. So they were good lessons. And then when I turned 40, I gave myself a creative writing course, an online creative writing course. And I did it online and overseas because I'd worked in publishing in Australia, and I thought my fiction writing might be so terrible. I'd be mortified if anyone in Australia saw my attempted work. So I did, I think it was an 8-week online course, and that quite suited me because I knew I wouldn't be able to get to a physical school just with young children and work. It was just really busy. So, and at the end of that, you had to submit 3,000 words, and there would be an editor, and it was Penguin Random House in England, and they would read a piece that you submitted, and I submitted this 3,000 words. And I can't believe, I look back at it and I think, did I show that 3,000 words to anyone? It's so bad. But she wrote a very kind review of the piece back to me, and she said, if you can sustain a novel with this voice, I think that you have no doubt that it will be edited and published. And that was The Midsummer Garden. So I decided to treat myself as a writer then, and I gave myself 6 months to finish the manuscript and send it out to agents. And then I was picked up by Curtis Brown in Australia and overseas, and then my book, my first novel, went to auction, and they bought that, and they said, do you have a second novel? At the time that they bought that, and I had just been on holidays with my family in Shanghai. And I, to my great shame, I had no idea of the Jewish ghetto and the Jewish history of Jewish refugees in Shanghai in the Second World War. And so I said, well, yes, I do have a story, to my publishers. And I wrote a proposal that day, and that became The Song of the Jade Lily.
And what is it about historical fiction that you enjoy writing?
I think I really enjoy discovering forgotten pockets of history, things that have been slightly overlooked in the history texts and also in fiction. And I think I love delving into stories of often I'm asked about writing, why I write about strong women. But to me, women have always been strong. I don't think that has changed through history. I just think they haven't been written about, and they weren't given a voice because they were getting on with the business of, you know, raising families and taking them across the seas to new nations, and just had their heads down working hard. And so I wanted to give voice to those women and kind of pay homage, in a way, if you like, to the people that really have forged our history. Who forged the history of people who've gone before us. So I think And I think history teaches us so many lessons. We always say that we won't forget, but I knew if I wrote a story about immigration and refugees in Australia in contemporary times, it would be really unpalatable and didactic. People in Australia and perhaps America would turn away from that because it's a really fraught and emotional topic. But you put it in history and people can really connect. And so many people said with the Song of the Jade Lily, oh, I can see why people left their home. I can see why they left Europe and put their family on a boat and went to Asia. You'd do anything to save your family. So I think historical history and the lessons that it teaches us allows us to kind of walk in another person's shoes, like Atticus Finch said. And
hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And I think, you know, of course, when I wrote The Lost Jewels, I had no idea that in Australia, we've had the worst bushfires this year that we've ever seen across our country. And now we are all locked inside because of a crazy plague sweeping the globe. And I think the lessons of history in The Lost Jewels, London, is almost a character. I mean, that's a city that has been razed to the ground so many times. And I talk about Wren's Monument in the book, which was a monument built after the Great Fire of London. And it's got London personified as a woman, and she's on her knees and she's being helped up by God and charity and some of the mercantile classes. And the thing about London is she rises again and again, and each time she's more diverse city and more glittering. She's stronger. She's more embracing of people from different places. And I think in this period, lessons from history show me that we're going to be okay. I mean, it's really hard and we're all separated from our loved ones, and you know, great losses are being suffered. But what people are realizing is that things that get us through are hope and resilience and community and reaching out and connecting with people. Like, that is all the stuff. People are recalibrating at the moment what is precious to them, and The Lost Jewels is about what is precious. You know, what is the meaning of jewelry? Is it the value of the jewelry? Is it in the craftsmanship, or is it in the promise when somebody gives you a piece of jewelry? Because that is always a gesture. That is always a promise. And it's about, you know, living with hope, and how hope, when you lose everything else, when everything else is taken away from you, when you're shut down, when you lose everything, how do you pick yourself up and carry on? How do you reset yourself like a piece of jewelry and carry on? And I think lessons of people past, like women who lived through the suffragettes, people who lived through the plague, people who lived through the Great Fire, they've all done this, and they can all show us how to kind of set forth and go.
So that's great. I'm curious, what writing advice would you offer for listeners who are writing their own stories and novels?
Look, I think it is to understand that self-doubt is a normal part of the process. I mean, I find myself cowering at my ideas, but I think the thing is to remember that writing is a verb. And you are a writer once you start writing, and just to push through, because I have days where it just kind of flows and other days where it's agony. But I sit down and I write every single day, and especially when you're starting out, writing is a craft like anything else. Like, if you were training for a marathon, you wouldn't just go out and write a marathon. You'd go for a jog, and you'd jog for a minute, and walk for a bit and then you'd jog for another minute. And writing's like that. If you just do a little bit constantly and build up, you'll find that your skill really improves. And you'll look back at some of the words that you put down on the page and it'll be like a little present to your future self, because sometimes you'll cringe, but you'll find more and more often you'll say, actually, that isn't bad. And the other thing to remember is you cannot edit something that is unwritten, and the rewriting and the opportunity to edit and go over and just smooth out sentence by sentence your work is very precious. So I think my advice to writers would be just keep writing, get those words down, keep going. Understand that self-doubt is normal, but don't use it as an excuse to stymie your work. Just put those words down, and in a day or a week or a year, when you look back at it, you'll be grateful for those words that you've written.
That's great advice. So are you working on another novel now?
I have just delivered a novel and to my publishers in America and to Australia. And so that is kind of a dual time frame, another history. And that kind of starts in pre-war France and goes into the Second World War. So it's a gritty book, but my publisher got back to me the other day and she thinks it's my best yet. So that was delightful. And that was one that I was really stymied with doubt. So if any of you listeners are there, I just thought, I don't know, how can I honour this topic and deliver it in a way that's meaningful for readers but also fresh. And so, you know, that's in. There's a long way to go in the editing. And I'm just putting together some pitches for a few more books. So I've got two ideas that have been kind of rattling around in my head, and I've kind of nailed out the structure of one the other day, so I'm very excited. Again, it's on a forgotten piece of history, so I just was it sometimes takes me a few months to work out the right angle to approach the story, and I go for lots of long walks and mull over, and then suddenly, you know, almost the structure of the book will fall out in a day. It's crazy. I don't know. I can't explain. There's no science to it, but there's something that happens in your subconscious, I think.
And so what is the writing process like for you, given what you just described? Do you work at that kind of in your head until you have the right angle? And then from there, when you have the right angle, how much of an outline do you write before you dive into the book and start the actual writing?
Great question. I have the kernel of an idea, and I have a notebook that I will start jotting down characters, and I'll start playing with names and maybe giving them attributes. And while I'm doing that, I'm reading really widely and deeply into my research. So The Lost Jewels, I was reading about goldsmiths in London, and reading about the Great Fire and Samuel Pepys' diary, the serial philanderer and public servant who kept a diary of the Great Fire, but also buried his Parmesan cheese in the backyard to preserve it. So little quirks. And when you're reading history, you pick up little quirks of characters and think about how you fold them into your book. And so I kind of get an idea of who my cast is going to be, and I start looking at the places I'm going to set it and researching that, and then I'll do that for a few months, and I'll just let it bubble away, and I'll take a notebook and start writing, like maybe get an idea. I have an idea of the beginning, the opening scene and the ending scene, and I'll jot those down. And then when I'm really serious, like the other day when I had to get a pitch in, I sit down in Scrivener, which is a writing program. And it's enormously helpful for any listeners out there, for writers, but especially if you're writing from multiple points of view or time frame, because you can map out the different threads of your storyline, the different narrative threads, and you can almost see at a glance, I mean, it's not a science, but you can see at a glance whether you've got too much of one storyline or too much of another, or you can really, and then I kind of put in the beginning, I put in the ending, I put in a couple of key turning points in the book, and then there'll be a couple of scenes that I really want to get in there that I've read from my history, and I think that's really important that kind of gets that moment, gets passed on to the reader. So I'll put a few of those in. But the trick is, of course, when you're writing historical fiction, not to let the history dictate the story, which is, I'm getting better at not just downloading history. You have to really write a cracking plot and beautiful characters and let the history not be the scaffolding for that. The plot and the characters are the scaffolding of the book, and then the history is layered on after that. I'm getting better at finding out what I need to know. So I will do Scrivener. And then the joy of Scrivener is once I've got a plan, it's not an exact plan, but it's a line with a few key points. The other great thing about Scrivener is it's got a word count feature on it. And so I turn that on and I have my date that I want the first draft of my manuscript finished. And it literally calculates how many words a day you have to write to hit that date. And I think being a journalist, the thing is you just write words. You know, give me 1,000 words by tonight, give me 2,000 words by tomorrow, give me 3,000 words, on Wednesday, and then you'll have 3 or 4 articles going. So writing a chunk of words quickly is my happy place. And I find that if I write, I think it's that business of being a writer, if I write regularly, especially at the beginning, because you don't really know exactly who your characters are. It takes me about 20,000 words really to feel what my characters are, and almost to the end of the book to work out what the real themes of the book are. And then you go, ah, okay, I see what's happening here. And then you go back to the beginning and really beef up your characters and give them all backbone based on, how the story has evolved. Because, of course, as the plot continues, you work out how your characters would react to certain situations, and that really determines, who they become, and you might want to kind of have a tinker with that at the beginning again. So I think the discipline of writing. Having said that, I can go through periods where I'm really quite stymied, and that's when I was talking about going for the long walks. And with this book I last delivered, it's about quite a difficult topic. We're in isolation. It was quite, it delves into some quite, I guess, some dark trauma, and it's can be a hard place to have carry that in your head. So I would say to readers, if you're writing about dark things, sometimes exercise and sunshine and fresh air, is really important. So the walking just became a way of just making sure that I stay buoyant, if you like. And that's as much a part of writing as anything else, because you can get really wrapped up in your story. And when you have children and a family, and especially when you're in lockdown with them 24/7, they don't give you a lot of space to be in your head all the time. So you need to find a way to kind of get in and out of your story quickly. And I find Scrivener and writing regularly does that. But having said that, at the end, just before my manuscript is delivered, I'll often have like a huge creative flurry where I will write thousands of words, or I'll cut thousands of words. I'll kind of see the true line of the story, and it will come together. So I guess I am truly journalistic in that regard, in that I write up right to that final hour. I wish I were that person that has it prepared months in ahead. And with my next book, I've made promises to myself. Never again, I said. But, I've been saying that since my university thesis, so we'll see.
We'll see. So what novels or nonfiction have you read recently that you enjoyed?
Well, I'm in the middle of one at the moment by Leila F. Sayed, Me and White Supremacy. to recognize your privilege, combat racism, and change the world, because I think we all need to try a bit harder. And I'm trying to kind of educate myself in areas that maybe I haven't. I have always felt that I was across, but, you know, I'm listening a lot more. So I am reading that. I have read some memoirs of people in wartime era, and I've been reading a bit about pre-war France, which has been fascinating, and life on the Riviera, which has also been fascinating. There's a book called it just escapes me. Anyway, there was a history on the Riviera, which I've just read. I've got on my desk here, I've got Sally Rooney's Conversations with Friends. I read Normal People, but I missed Conversations with Friends, and I understand that's very remiss of me, so because she's a wonderful writer. So I'm having a read of that at the moment. And I've got a book here that I bought. I've got Anne Patchett's new novel, The Dutch House, that I'm about to start. And I've also got a book that I bought for one of my teenagers called Flow, which is the classic work on how to achieve happiness, because I bought it for everyone to read in lockdown, and nobody has bothered to read it. Teachers have said thanks, talk to the hand, and so I'm reading it.
Good. Good. So where can people find you online if they'd like to learn more about you and your novels?
Oh, I love to hear from people. So I'm at Kirsty Manning AU on Instagram and kirstymanning.com on my website, and there's a contact page. So you can email me there. But Instagram, Kirsty Manning AU, and Facebook, I'm Kirsty Manning Writer.
Great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Kirsty Manning, author of the new novel, The Lost Jewels. The novel is available now, so go buy a copy. And Kirsty, thanks for doing this interview.
Thank you very much.
And now stay tuned for a brief excerpt from the audiobook of The Lost Jewels by Kirsty Manning, narrated by Natasha Beaumont, published by Harper Audio, and available wherever audiobooks are sold.
The smoke was so thick she had to draw her apron across her mouth. Her long plaits were singed black from falling fire drops. They'd need to be chopped off. Mama would be furious. But she had made a promise to Papa. She had to see it through, even though the roar of flames raced through the narrow cobblestone streets. No one would be missing her yet. Mama would be passing under London Bridge in the longboat with the baby, both wrapped in heavy woolen blankets to protect them from the embers raining down. The girl had begged, then pushed mother and baby into the overcrowded boat as barrels of oil and tallow exploded behind her, promising she would jump in the boat behind. Think of the baby! Papa would! Her words had been whipped away by the searing easterly, and the boat was swallowed by the haze as it left the dock. Onshore was chaos as families unloaded trunks and leather buckets filled with their most precious goods. Horses snorted with terror and threw their heads back. Hooves clanged against cobblestones. The beasts' ears were pinned back with fear. The girl was grateful her mama and little Samuel were gone, safe. The flustered captain had braced his leg against the timber wharf to steady the boat. He'd held out a hand to the girl, but she'd stepped backwards into the smoke and shower of embers, turned on her heels and ran. She'd kept running uphill away from the Thames until she could make out the line of St. Paul's steeple, tall and grey against the orange sky. The cathedral's stones exploded like gunpowder as she fought her way through the panicking crowd streaming towards the river. Her steps slowed now as she trod carefully, looking down to avoid the rivulets of lead and shit flowing over the cobbles. She put a hand out to feel her way along the walls. Her fingers trailed across rough timber beams as her boots crunched over broken glass. The girl had lived and played in these streets and lanes all her life, and she counted them as she passed. Ironmonger, king, honey, milk, wood, butter, then Foster Lane, almost home. The two buildings flanking hers were engulfed in red flames. Men with rolled-up sleeves were trying to douse the fire with paltry buckets of water. The fire hissed and roared up the walls and across the wooden shingles, as if laughing at the people below.
"Get away! It's too late! Drayter Blackfriars! St. Paul's is afire!"
It was too late to turn back. Not when she was so close to home. Not when she'd promised Papa. The frenzied chimes of St. Mary Le Bow's church drew her closer, and she inched through the thick smoke. When she felt the familiar wrought iron number beside her front door, she threw herself against the door and forced it open. As horses cantered past and people scrambled to climb onto carts, headed for the docks or beyond the city walls, nobody paid any attention as the girl slipped inside number 32. Her chest was burning, as if with each breath she was drawing the fire deep into her lungs. Tears formed, but she wiped them away with her filthy sleeve. Now was not the time for self-pity. Instead, she fell to her knees and crawled over the blue Persian carpet in the entry hall and into the tiny room beyond, Papa's special workshop. Quick as a lark, she removed the key tied to a ribbon around her neck. She kept it tucked under her clothes whenever he was away on one of his trips, like a talisman to sing him home. The firestorm surged. Heat poured in through the smashed windows and the open front door. The thunk of timber beams and collapsing houses surrounded her. The shingles atop her own roof started to smoulder and whistle. Time was running out. The girl unlocked the door and hurried down the narrow stairs, stepping into the chilly cellar. She felt a moment's relief. It was so calm, so quiet after the tumult of the streets. She squatted to find the telltale bump in the dirt. It was their secret and she had to retrieve it. She knew Papa would understand. She'd promised him she would look after Mama and little Samuel, but the coins hastily wrapped in Mama's shawl wouldn't last long. She mumbled a quick prayer, then seized the shovel stowed in the corner and started to dig.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.